One of the joys of listening to classical music is hearing history move along from this to this to this to this. Noting how Beethoven added new intervals to the acceptable musical vocabulary. Noting how French has its own harmonic sound. And how distinctively Russian something can be. And so on through the ages, oh so gradually. Even when the changes are gradual, audiences of the time gasp to hear a new chord, a new harmonic advance, and then they embrace it. Arnold Schoenberg's harmonic revelations could not be considered particularly gradual, having gone from this to this in just a few years. Schoenberg broke every harmonic rule and created new ones of his own. And he also broke the unspoken rule that said these changes have to happen over generations so audiences can absorb them. Audiences could not. And as composers of the succeeding generation fell under his spell, some never forgave him for having, as they said, destroyed music.
Well, isn't it amazing that such an interesting personality somehow isn't a part of people's general consciousness, the way other fascinating figures from his time are.
Alan Shawn's book, Arnold Schoenberg's Journey, is a new look at the man responsible for what was seen as a harmonic assault. There's a photo of the composer on the cover, and he's looking very human, gazing quizzically into the camera.
I fought very hard to have it be the really terrific picture of him holding his hat in his hands and standing on a ship where, you know, he really looks like he's on a kind of magical and strange voyage that surprises even him.
Schoenberg's strange voyage took him from the 19th century into the 20th, from Vienna to Hollywood, and from an explosion of success to almost total alienation from the music community. And now, back again, perhaps, he emerges from Shawn's book as a complicated, sympathetic man possessed by genius, compelled to bring music into what was then the future, having begun in the most logical way, as a composer immersed in classical tradition.
He was steeped in the three Bs, basically, and one M, Mozart. He adored Mozart.
He had taken the music world by storm with Verklärte Nacht, Transfigured Night, and Gurlieder, a gigantic two-hour song cycle.
When Arnold Schoenberg was young, he had a tremendous success and notoriety, which won him great praise from Strauss and various other important musicians of the day.
Fred Sherry has just recorded the Schoenberg Mon Cello Concerto.
However, as soon as he diverged from the path of the great classical music around Opus 11, everybody gave up on him, and he became a submerged figure that never came up in the public's mind again.
And yet he, as they say, went there.
Once he opened the door to the new kind of harmony that he heard, he really couldn't ever turn back from that. And I believe that the aspect of newness in Schoenberg's music is everywhere.
It was a step being taken in the arts in general in this period as World War I was on the horizon. It was unique in history.
To go from painting in which you can recognize right off the bat what the objects were that were in front of the painter to paintings in which you're looking at forms and compositions without any clear reference, that's an unbelievable step.
And the parallel in music is starting out knowing you're in one key or another.
To go from that to music in which you are not in a key at any point and you do not resolve into a key at the end, that is simply an astonishing thing.
Even our hero, Arnold Schoenberg, and his circle were astonished.
Webern uses the word panic about that moment in their work when they realized that it no longer actually was true to the piece to pretend that it had been tonal. To simply display a tonal coat of arms, to use Schoenberg's phrase, at the end of a piece when it hasn't been tonal at any other point, it felt dishonest and ridiculous.
So he went all the way.
You might say he relaxed. he faced the implications of the language that, in fact, he was using. Those sounds were valued in a new way for their own sake. And in the book of the Hanging Gardens, I think Schoenberg found that there was an incredible beauty and magic to letting that language of tones be what it really wanted to be. There are songs in there that are like Gershwin if he was, you know, maybe stoned or something. They're so beautiful, they just don't happen to resolve. You want to sing along, and every single song is just so fantastic.
Singing along with Schoenberg may be the province of a special few. He didn't make it easy. But knowing more about the man helps, and Sean's book reveals maybe a kinder, gentler Schoenberg.
Well, I mean, gentle is not exactly the word we would use, is it? But kind, definitely. I mean, he tried tremendously hard to help colleagues and friends who were trapped in Nazi Germany when he himself had gotten out. He himself was impoverished, but he taught Berg for free because he believed in Berg's talent.
Even when he was borrowing rent money from Gustav Mahler.
I once talked to Larry Schoenberg about his father, and Larry mentioned that he was a very sweet man at home, and he would pack lunches for them to go to school with, and he would make the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in the shape of eighth notes and other musical forms.
What a guy. The interesting thing is that Schoenberg was compelled to break the rules, but he craved acceptance as much as any artist. The letter of his I keep coming back to is the one written on the 12th of May, 1947, from California to Hans Rosbaud. "There's nothing I long for more intensely," Schoenberg writes, "than to be taken for a better sort of Tchaikovsky, or if anything more, than that people should know my tunes and whistle them." I don't know if I'm ready to whistle his tunes, but 51 years after his death, the world seems readier than it's ever been to make his wish come true. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fischko.
If you'd like to find out anything more about Arnold Schoenberg, check out our website, studio360.org.